Thank you for those readings. I add my welcome to that of Daz's. It's wonderful to have you here tonight. My name's Luke, and I'd love to chat to you afterwards if you're feeling new tonight. Before we get underway, I just wanted to acknowledge the work and the involvement of those people who have been doing kids' games for the last, well, it feels like a lot, last week. Put your hand up if you were involved in any way at kids' games. Wow, that's amazing. And you're all exhausted, so you're like... let's do a bit better round of applause for the people. Yeah, good. Kids Games, if you're not aware, has been running since the Barcelona Olympics. There you go. And it has been an opportunity to connect with our local community, particularly kids and families, but it's been a wonderful opportunity for people to lead in... sort of step up and lead in different ways in ministry here at St. Mark's, as well as a lot of intergenerational serving which has been going on through the week. It's been such an encouragement just to watch it all happen. It's been great to see Daz sort of fresh into the role, kind of stepping up and leading that team. We're hoping and praying that there'll be much fruit in a lot of different ways through that ministry. So just be encouraged that God is... really doing some wonderful things here amongst the people and the different ways that people are serving. We are continuing tonight this series which we're calling Questions for God. And I mentioned last week we have a bunch of these books available which have helped shape a number of the talks in this series. Tonight's the last of the mini-series that we've been doing, and you can pick up a book in the foyer. We'll be coming back to this series in the next school holidays. But the question that we're looking at tonight is this one. How can you say that there is only one true faith? In a world with so many different religions, spiritualities, belief systems, the claim that Christianity is the one true religion smacks of either extreme naivety or extreme arrogance, or possibly a combination of both. The British comedian Rowan Atkinson, in one of his famous sketches, plays the devil as he is welcoming people to hell, and he's doing this presentation to those who have just arrived, and he kind of says, "Atheists, you're over here, you must be feeling ridiculously stupid right now." And then he says, "Christians, you're over here. I'm sorry to say the Jews were right." And he kind of, you know, he's kind of making a mockery of all the different belief systems. And to claim that there is only one true faith can be routinely mocked by atheists who find the whole idea comical and absurd and ridiculously small-minded. But other people who are more open to the idea of belief in God... compared to atheists, people who are more open to the idea of spirituality in general, they also find the claim that Christians make to the exclusivity of Christian faith quite problematic. But their concern is not so much the comical naivety of Christians, but the fact that Christians who claim that their faith is the only true faith is such an arrogant and disrespectful thing to claim. It's incredibly close-minded. It's such an unloving thing and disrespectful thing to say. So while the atheist might reject all claims of belief in God outright, the alternative claim by the theists or the deists is to assert that religious pathways, in a sense, are all kind of have all got merit. They're all equally valid pathways to God. You might hear it said, no one religious faith has the monopoly on God. All religious faiths are different expressions or pathways to the same God. This is often explained through the well-known Hindu parable. You might have heard it before, of the blind people trying to describe the elephants. And there's an image there which I think kind of captures it. One blind person touches the elephant's trunk and confidently asserts that the elephant is like a snake. There's another one, feels its ear, says, no, first person, you're wrong. It's actually like a fan. The other one grabs the tusks and says, no, the first two people are wrong. It's much more like a spear. You kind of get the point. The parable is intended to humble those who are so resolved and determined to assert that their religion is true and everyone else's is false. That's its kind of purpose. It's kind of intended to demonstrate the limitations that we have as individuals to grasp the whole truth. And to a certain extent, there are a whole bunch of lessons that we are always keen to learn when it comes to epistemic humility. Our knowledge is limited. The perspective of others is so important in life and understanding the world, in navigating relationships. But the elephant parable, this as a way to make sense of the diversity of religious beliefs and claims about God, is itself a deeply problematic parable. If you step back and you see what the lesson of this kind of this kind of parable is, the author is actually making an incredibly arrogant truth claim themselves, aren't they? They are claiming that they're the only ones who can actually see the objective reality of the whole elephant. And the only way we can know that all these blind people are actually describing parts of the elephant is that we ourselves are not blind. So the author of this parable is claiming that only they possess the ability to see the whole elephant. They're kind of confidently asserting something that in and of itself is an incredibly arrogant, disrespectful claim to a statement to make to people of all different kind of religious beliefs. Rebecca McLaughlin, in her book, she outlines seven problems with this claim that all religions are a pathway to the truth. And I'm not going to go into each of them today. I commend the book to you if you would like to read up about them. But one of the problems she highlights is the approach that when you say all religions are equal paths to the truth, is that it is a failure to respect people. Now, there's one quote of one of her professors where the professor said, "It's often said that you should respect other people's beliefs, but that's actually wrong. What's vital is that you respect other people." When we think respect requires respecting the beliefs of other people, we can inadvertently, by showing people that we know and love, we can actually inadvertently show them a great deal of disrespect. I'll explain what I mean. If a doctor knows his or her patient has a serious health condition that needs urgent treatment, but the patient strongly believes they don't have that serious health condition, what should the doctor do? What is the most loving, respectful thing to do? Well, the most loving, respectful thing to do is to seek to persuade the patient that the patient's beliefs about themselves are actually wrong. If respecting the beliefs of others and not respecting other people was the main priority, we would actually be in great danger of showing a huge amount of disrespect to people with different beliefs because we assume their incapacity to change their mind. We assume that their ability to change their mind, that can't happen, and we have a disregard for the consequences. One of the other areas of confusion for many people is where, when you talk about religious claims, what category of truth does it fit into? Because we're talking about the divine, the existence of God, in many ways it's tricky to categorically, in terms of empirically, prove its existence in the here and now in that kind of way. So what often happens is the idea of religious truth claims more fits into the category of, for many people, of opinion. It's like saying my dog is better than your dog, right? You can hold it very, very strongly, but it's still, if we're being honest, it is a matter of personal conviction. It's different to saying, so stop smoking, it will kill you. That's a personal conviction about an objective truth. We mustn't separate these things so much that we actually have big problems. So when we look at some of these objective truth claims, it's interesting when you look at something like the Me Too movement a number of years ago, where women were encouraged to come forward and share for the first time often the damage that had been done by particularly a number of men in particularly powerful positions towards them. And sometimes the language was often share, it's important that you share your truth, right? And so this your truth language on the surface seemed like a very empowering way of allowing women to speak who had previously been silenced, but to say the end goal is not that people have your truth. The end goal is that the truth is actually received not just as this person's truth, this woman's truth, but the objective truth. This is what happened. This is what happened. It's incredibly disrespectful and disempowering to women who come forward and say, this is my truth, if there is no affirmation that what they claimed happened actually happened. Now, there are plenty of problems with all these various truth claims getting muddled into objective truth being rejected in the name of arrogance, and kind of you end up tying yourself in all these kind of knots, because what you're trying to do, you're actually doing the exact opposite of what you're claiming. You are being incredibly disrespectful, unloving, by claiming that all religious beliefs all have a little bit of truth and they're all equally valid. Now, I want to spend the rest of my time, you'll probably be pleased to know, looking at the claims of the Christian faith. Any serious examination of the life and the teachings of Jesus will struggle to conclude that it's possible to be a follower of Jesus and also accept the truth of other alternative religious beliefs. Because when you look at Jesus, what he said, what he did, he himself will not allow that. A telltale sign that someone hasn't actually looked at the life and teachings of Jesus is to suggest you can follow Jesus and follow a whole range of other religious beliefs. In John's Gospel, as we heard, the famous saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus didn't say, I am a way, I am a truth. And just to be extra sure that they're not doing any clever things with the Greek grammar or anything like that, it's written in the negative as well. No one comes to the Father except through me. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, it can be popular at a popular level, common to just kind of dismiss Jesus as a good teacher and not much more. But you actually can't really say he's a good teacher without also accepting his claim that he is the only way to God. He can't kind of be a good teacher, but he's kind of wrong about that bit, because it's kind of a big bit of what he teaches. Jesus went further at the end of Matthew's gospel after the resurrection. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. That's a very big claim. It can be popular among celebrity circles to treat Christianity a little bit like as a cultural badge or a marker of your upbringing. Pop star Taylor Swift, talking about her song You Need to Calm Down, takes aim at Christian fundamentalists. And she says that she wrote the song as a Christian, lamenting the intolerance of other Christians who arrogantly think they have a monopoly on God. And yet when you, as far as you can tell, when Taylor Swift says she's a Christian, she seems to be referring to her upbringing, the example of Jesus, the model, the qualities of Jesus she likes. I don't see any evidence that she suggests and should be happy to go on record to say that Jesus is the only way to know God. I'm not sure she'd be happy to go on record to say all authority in heaven on earth has been given to Jesus. The Jesus of history, the Jesus in history, was and is a polarizing figure. when Jesus healed the paralyzed man, before he did that, he pronounced the forgiveness of sins, and he caused immediate outrage among the religious leaders for good reasons. The religious leaders were outraged that Jesus could casually presume to pronounce something that belonged exclusively to God, the forgiveness of sins. The religious leaders rightly could see that you can't just go around blurring the lines between what belongs exclusively to God and what we can go on about. We can kind of go do this and do that. Yeah, you can forgive this, forgive that. It's all easy to do. It doesn't really matter. We can, the religious leaders were rightly outraged that Jesus was doing things and claiming to do things that exclusively belonged to God. The forgiveness of sins. They were right to be outraged. If we just go around forgiving sins, saying, you know, you're right with God, you're right with God, you're right with God, just going like that, it severely downplays the seriousness of sin and presumes it can just be done away with a word of tolerance. But where the religious leaders were so wrong is they didn't look carefully at the person of Jesus. The Bible describes their hearts were hardened. They didn't see that Jesus was doing things that only God could do. Jesus was demonstrating like no other person in history who has ever walked the face of the earth. He was sinless, demonstrating the very power and presence of God in human flesh. I think at the heart of a lot of people's concerns about the exclusive truth claims of Christianity is the assumption that to be a Christian either means we've been brainwashed since birth, we're being in an echo chamber, only believing the God we were raised to believe in. People are concerned that's an incredibly naive and foolish and closed-minded thing. Or it's incredibly arrogant. It suggests that Christians have somehow lined up the world religions and chosen the one that they're convinced is right and everything else is wrong. It kind of sound like Christians are claiming this kind of, they're smarter than millions of people, billions of people who are not Christians. It can come across incredibly arrogant when it's presented that way, isn't it? Ricky Gervais, another famous atheist, speaking to Stephen Colbert about why he's an atheist, said to Stephen Colbert, a professing Catholic, he said, "You believe in one God, but there are 3,000 to choose from, Stephen." I don't know where he got that number from, but anyway. "You deny one less God than I do. You don't believe in 2,999 gods, and I don't believe in just one more." That's his argument. He tries to argue for the integrity of his atheistic worldview by suggesting that a Christian is someone who chooses one God out of 3,000 possibilities, claiming theirs is the right one. For Ricky Gervais, he's presenting Christianity like it's kind of people sticking their hand into a bucket of 3,000 cards, each with a different religion named on it, and you pull out the card at random and you spend the rest of your life defending the one that you pulled out. It must be the true one. But the problem with this assumption is that we believe in God because we've kind of chosen our God out of a list of thousands of possible options. A Christian historian, apologist, Wes Huff, if you might have heard of him, he's been on a number of different podcasts recently, he rejected Ricky Gervais's suggestion that there is no God because there are so many different claims to God, saying competition doesn't negate objective reality. And he gives a helpful example. He says it's like being in a courtroom on trial for a murder and saying to the judge, "Look, there are 5 million people in this city. Out of all the people, you think I'm the one who committed the crime? What are the chances? Do you realize how naive you are sounding, judge? Do you realize how arrogant that makes you sound? Out of all the people in the city, you think I'm the one who committed the crime?" It's that kind of argument. The Christian faith is not about choosing one faith from a multitude of potential options and then vigorously defending it. It's about responding to the compelling historical evidence of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This has always been the way for Christians. It's the reason why the first disciples, who were confused cowards scratching their heads before the resurrection, but after the resurrection, so sure of what they had witnessed, they were willing to be martyred rather than denying following Jesus. I think the way that questions are phrased can often force people into arguing a point they're not particularly keen to make or argue. And when someone objects to Christianity with the question that we're looking at tonight, how can you say there is only one true faith? The way it's phrased, we can often as Christians find ourselves being forced into the kind of philosophical debates that we've been touching on tonight. But I think a much better question that really gets much more to the heart of why Christians make the exclusive truth claims that they do is, how can you say that Jesus rose from the dead and conquered death, never to die again? Or something to that effect. I don't want to pretend to speak on behalf of other monotheistic religions, but for Christians, the exclusive truth claim of the Christian faith is all about the exclusive historical reality of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. No one else in history did what Jesus did. The Apostle Paul said as much in 1 Corinthians 15, the objective truth of the Christian faith is seen in these events. If Christ has not been raised, then our proclamation is without foundation, and so is your faith. How can you say there is only one true faith? Well, in a sense, we can't say there is only one true faith. None of us can. We can search, we can fumble in the dark like the blind men with the elephant, but none of us by ourselves can say there is only one true faith like we are detectives cracking the case. But God can. God did. In the famous events of the Transfiguration, while Jesus was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them. And a voice from the cloud said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." Listen to him. Let's pray. Father, we give you thanks that you have made yourself known. We thank you that you haven't left us fumbling around in the dark. We thank you that you haven't left us to our intellect, to our IQ, to understand you. We thank you that you have shown yourself to us in your Son. And we ask that you'll guard us from any dangers of arrogance that can come from the way that we speak about the truth of your Son. And we ask that you'll guard us also from a cowardly not wanting to speak in the name of tolerance and truth that is relative. We ask that you'll help us to see that reality now and into eternity is all determined by you and what you've done for us in your Son. We ask this in his name. Amen.